I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. President Obama has called the 113th Congress the least productive in modern history. Speaker of the House John Boehner has sued the president, accusing the White House of overstepping its executive authority by making a change in the Affordable Care Act. That pretty much describes the atmosphere in Washington these days as the U.S. government grapples or doesn't grapple or fights about grappling with serious domestic and international crises. We asked Robert Costa and Jay Newton Small to join us before the lawmakers and the Obama family take their August vacations and as the 2014 and 2016 elections begin to take shape. Robert Costa is national political reporter at the Washington Post, formerly Washington editor at the National Review. Robert Costa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be back, Marty.
Also with us, as I said, Jay Newton Small. She is the congressional correspondent for Time. Before that, she covered politics for Bloomberg News. And Jay, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me back, Marty.
Jay, let me begin with you. Is President Obama correct when he calls this Congress the most unproductive in recent history?
Well, they're not officially finished yet. They still have a few more months left on the term, but thus far, in comparison to rather recent Congresses, yes, it has been the least productive in at least 40 years.
And is that just because bills are not being passed? Is that the criteria?
Yes, bills passed, signed into law, those kinds of things. Even in terms of oversight, they haven't done as much as you would imagine that they should be doing in terms of the House oversight of Obama. But, I mean, essentially, it's a dual factor here. You've got, last year, the shutdown of the House, or of the government, which sort of brought work to a standstill. And then a few months later, you had Harry Reid trigger what's known as the nuclear option, which essentially blew up the Senate, in which he changed the rules for to make it more difficult for the minority to filibuster certain presidential nominations. And so, and that has literally brought the Senate to a standstill in the last 8 months, where they've done virtually almost nothing. And they're just still in a very hyperpartisan, very acrimonious sort of relationships between the majority and the minority. So between those two factors, there really hasn't been a lot of legislation that's made it through.
Is this a definition of government dysfunction, Robert Costa?
Yes and no. If you step back a little bit and you think to when the House Republicans won the majority in 2010, ever really since they took power in January 2011, we've had a standoff on Capitol Hill. There's not been much bipartisan legislation. There's been a lot of acrimony, and we've had several fiscal impasses where both sides have struggled to come together. And before the midterm elections, we're now seeing the parties really begin to posture and position ahead of November. And I think that was always going to be the game plan for the next few months. However, I think a wrench has been thrown into the mix. And we've seen, because of immigration, because of foreign policy crisis, we've now seen some more issues float up into the debate, and that's really changed what was going to be a laid-back summer where you would have Senate Democrats focused on income inequality and bills that would raise the minimum wage, and you would have House Republicans hammer the Affordable Care Act and not really do much on immigration reform.
Are you saying immigration reform is still a possibility, Robert?
Well, it depends on how you define immigration reform.
Exactly.
It's comprehensive immigration reform, unlikely. But it's interesting to see, when you look at Speaker John Boehner's lawsuit, he goes after the Affordable Care Act, but it does not, in terms of going after the president's executive actions, target immigration. And I think that gives a little bit of space, a little bit of wiggle room for Boehner to cut some kind of smaller deal about the current border crisis and the children coming up from the Americas. But any kind of path to legalization in this heated political environment is very unlikely.
Jay, let me go back to you and just picking up on the migration crisis, as it has been called, on the Texas-Mexico border. President Obama asked for $3.7 billion to deal with the crisis. Is that going anywhere in Congress?
No, in fact, just yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said he didn't think that there was even enough bipartisanship left to do anything on dealing with the children and immigration, or even on fixing the veterans, the VA, the Veterans Affairs Department. So, there's just all of these major issues have popped up and boiled up, and they do need addressing, but You know, given the dysfunction in both chambers of Congress, it's looking incredibly unlikely. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't help, frankly, that both Reid and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi sort of backed off from the president's plan and haven't really been pushing it, haven't really said they, you know, support it for the $3.7 billion. Republicans have said it's way too much money. We're not going to do that. So they're sort of left without a plan right now or anyone really to shepherd anything through through Congress, which is a problem.
I'm curious why the Democratic leaders are not in support of President Obama's $3.7 billion. What's why is that? No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's not that they're not in support of the $3.7 billion. I think that if it were possible to get that through without any strings attached, that they would do it. It's just that when they sat down to negotiate, all of these things popped up about how you would treat whether, you know, Mexicans versus Central Americans differently. You know, any kind of sort of compromise here just seemed really unpalatable to both to the Democrats. And the amount of money was very unpalatable to the Republicans. And so they very, very quickly reached an impasse on both sides and kind of just threw up their hands and said, you know what, we're done. To which the administration was kind of like, well, what do you mean you're done? We need to do something here. And there really hasn't been a lot of progress in the last week to produce a bill, frankly.
Robert, going back to you, and even going back to this bill that was signed in 2008, the very end of the Bush administration, passed largely unanimously by Congress, this Wilberforce bill to protect children coming across the border against traffickers. Are we seeing the sort of unintended consequences of that bill and a very changed politics?
I think so. I think, however, many progressives are hesitant to start to tinker or tweak that 2008 law. And we are seeing some of the unintended consequences of immigration policy bubble up and really cause some headaches for people on Capitol Hill. I think Jay makes some great points about some of the Democratic hesitancy moving ahead. But one thing I just keep sensing when I'm at the Capitol over the past few days is that both sides realize something eventually needs to happen, even though there are a few work days left. And so the White House is asking for about $4 billion in aid. But at the same time, Republicans aren't totally ignoring it. I think they know in a lot of these swing districts in the suburbs of Philadelphia and elsewhere, if this festers, they may pay a political price. So you see Boehner has this task force. He's countered with the $1.4 billion. I think in the final few days of August, we're going to see that maybe $2 to $3 billion range come up as some kind of compromise area.
Well, I noticed that Governor Perry of Texas has called for stationing National Guard along guardsmen or guardswomen along the border there. Robert, I know you've been covering some of the presidential aspirants. Do you see this presidential politics kind of creeping into this immigration crisis?
Oh, certainly. It's creeping into both parties in a sense, but especially on the Republican side, where Perry, who was seen as the more compassionate Republican when he ran in 2012, and he got heat for it from conservatives, he's now going right at the president, and he's sending the National Guard to the border. And how this plays out, no one really knows, but I'll tell you this. When Perry was in Iowa over the weekend, he got a lot of applause for his immigration stance, his tough words for the president. And so that's playing into the debate ahead of 2016. And then you see people like Governor Chris Christie. He's more on the center-right side of things. And he's hesitant to really wade into the debate. He's been pretty quiet. And Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, some other major immigration voices on the right, they've been cagey because they know this is a delicate issue, especially if you have White House ambitions.
Well, and Jay, just picking up on that, because the stories that we're hearing from the border are children and mothers in many instances essentially going up to the border patrol and giving themselves up, which is very different from people sneaking across the border into the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these people don't sort of sneak across the border and kind of, you know, in the dark of the night. They literally, like these little kids, kind of come across the border and hand, you know, the Border Patrol a piece of paper that has their name on it and the name of their nearest living relative in the United States. I mean, these are 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. I mean, they're really, it's heartbreaking to see it happen. And I think that really plays into the politics of this. It's very hard, you know, when you're dealing with children, you know, do you deport them? Do you send them back to these incredibly violent, you know, gang-ridden countries? A lot of people on the left say that is essentially a death sentence. you know, that they should be able to stay here. There's a whole religious movement now about, you know, amongst the evangelicals about perhaps adopting some of these children, keeping them in the United States. And so the debate is pretty fierce about what we do. At the same time, you don't want to encourage more people to send their kids here because that's incredibly dangerous, you know. And so the more you're allowing them to stay, the more you're encouraging others to come. And that is also sort of a conundrum. So, you know, in trying to figure out a solution to all of this, you know, do you treat them like Cubans, where if they make it here, they can stay? Or do you treat them like Central Americans, where, you know, they have to immediately go home, or Mexicans? I mean, it's just, there's a lot of policy questions about how you do this, and then what are the long-term implications of it? And certainly, I think if you don't see, you'll see something coming out of Congress, as Robert said earlier, by the end of August. I think you're also going to, you know, you should watch for Obama to do something in September. He had this task force that he said, I want recommendations from the Attorney General on what to do. And he said he would not wait until after the elections, and then he would act immediately in September on those recommendations. And so he will also do something, you know, in September in terms of executive actions. And so we will see something on this before the elections. It's just a big question of, you know, what and how they do it in a way that doesn't encourage more children to come, but also, you know, treats those children, you know, that are here humanely and you know, hopefully, like, you know, gets them home or reunited with their families.
I mean, such a difficult issue, obviously, with concerns about the fate and the future of these children. But it's interesting, Robert, and then we're going to take a break and then move on to some other issues. The president has been criticized largely from the left and immigration reform people about the numbers of deportations under his administration. So it puts the president in this, I think, very interesting and curious place.
It does. And the president's political capital, I think, is in a more fragile position than it's been in a long time, because the reformers on the left are not really happy with his deportation policy. They think he has an incoherent response at times to some of the conservative critiques. And you see the president blaming the Republicans in Congress, but we're really going to have to see. This is a test for the president. He has a lot on his plate right now. Can he try to broker something in the House? Can he get something through the Senate? Or is it just still become a blame game? Eventually, Republicans, of course, are going to have to take a significant amount of responsibility, but this is still probably a major issue for the president, and it is a test, mm-hmm. and he has to get something done here. I'm not sure, though, how he's going to do it.
And how many people in Congress, Republicans in Congress, Robert, think that if Obama is for it, we're against it?
Well, that's the problem that's hung over Washington for the last few years, that the president has removed himself often to try to not taint the debate. But this is perhaps a moment not only for presidential leadership, but for congressional leadership. Where is the meetings between Speaker Boehner and President Obama? Really, as I said, since 2011, we've seen fewer and fewer meetings between Reid, Boehner, and Obama. The relationships have shattered, and that's a problem for the country, that at these moments that just come out of nowhere, in a sense, the leaders of the country are barely talking to each other.
That's Robert Costa. He's national political reporter for The Washington Post. Also with us, J. Newton Small. She's the congressional correspondent for Time. And we called them up to join us in this hour of Radio Times, taking a look at what's happening in Washington, or perhaps what's not happening in Washington. A very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. What do you want your government to do? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Dell Music Center supports WHYY and presents Roberta Fleck, Peabo Bryson, New Birth, and Bloodstone at the newly renovated Dell Music Center in Fairmount Park. Four legendary acts at the Dell, Thursday, July 24th at 8 p.m. On-site parking is also available. Information at 215-685-9560 or online at mydelleast.com. The Dell Music Center, where the stars take center stage.
In Studio 360, we take personal expression seriously.
We break fingers and bones and noses and jaws and chipped teeth.
Like the choreographer Elizabeth Streb, Studio 360 never plays it safe. Every week we bring you stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and new ideas.
I think if you're going to be a movement practitioner, you have to agree to get hurt, yeah.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Get inside the creative mind.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Advances in brain imaging technology may help predict learning disorders like dyslexia even before children learn how to read.
Maybe the most surprising aspect of the research so far is how clear a signal we see in the brains of children who are likely to go on to be poor readers.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with J. Newton Small and Robert Costa about Congress's hits and misses. We're also exploring the national political landscape. We've got midterm elections coming up in 2014, and the beginning outlines of the 2016 presidential campaign are beginning to take shape as well. Jay, let me go back to you, and you mentioned John Boehner and his lawsuit against the president. It seemed kind of, I'm not exactly sure what the right word was, but when he said it was a provision within the Affordable Care Act that he was going after, do you think people were expecting more from this suit?
I'm not sure what anyone was expecting from the suit. It's sort of unprecedented, right, for the speaker to sue the president. And disputes over implementation of laws has been around between presidents and Congress for, gosh, decades and decades, if not centuries. How the president interprets the law and chooses, you know, cherry picks what provisions he wants to implement right away and ones that he might not implement until later on, happens all the time, from Iranian sanctions to EPA regulations to the Affordable Care Act. I think, you know, Boehner obviously here chose the Affordable Care Act because it is the least popular thing out there from the, you know, the bill that the president has passed, and it keeps it in the news. It keeps it fresh on voters' minds. And I think certainly even you've seen folks like Eric Erickson in Red State and a lot of conservatives on the right say this is kind of a gimmicky. And, you know, this is sort of an election ploy. And there's not really, I don't know that there's a lot of people who think that it actually will go through. At the same time, you know, in the last 3 years, the Supreme Court itself has had, you know, half a dozen decisions where they've struck down parts of the president's policies. And so, you know, maybe it could go through. Who knows? I mean, you certainly saw, you know, for example, in the last session, they said that his recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board were, you know, unconstitutional. So there is the possibility it could go through. It depends on how it's, you know, and how it's heard and what happens with it. But I'm not sure that Boehner has many expectations for it, to sort of go beyond November in terms of, I mean, I think his first hope is that it happens, has an impact with voters, and then perhaps maybe down the road on the president himself.
To you, Robert Costa, do you think part of it was, quote unquote, firing up the base or keeping the Tea Party close?
I think that was probably the number one priority. Even if it's never publicly articulated, you have conservatives right now itching for some kind of combative strategy against the president. You have conservative favorite Tea Party darlings like Sarah Palin calling for the president's impeachment. And if you have that kind of movement brewing on the right, that puts Boehner in a corner. He still wants to run for the gavel once again this fall. And so he's trying to almost take a centrist route. It seems strange to suing the president seems like a more moderate position. But when you compare it to impeachment, perhaps it is. And so he's trying to shore up his right flank, move forward incrementally with a very divided Republican conference. I think the politics is that the chief undercurrent of all of this. However, I think Jay brings up some good points. There is some legal implications here because there is a chance, even if it's thrown out of court, that this could eventually make its way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court we've seen in recent years has been willing to consider some of these more politically controversial issues, especially those about executive power. And so we could see it end up there. And that would be interesting, especially to see the balance the Supreme Court believes there should be between Congress and the executive branch. But there's also a risk because in more swing districts, this lawsuit from Boehner may help in red states and red districts, but to some people think it's going to backfire. Is it too much for the Republicans to do this kind of thing? We'll have to see.
You mentioned Sarah Palin, and you know I've pretty much tried to banish any conversation about her on our airwaves. But who? This is to you, Robert Costa. Who takes her seriously? I mean, it seems, I'll be honest with you, it seems like she is in it for herself, for the attention that she wants, for whatever career path that she is on. But I do not understand why anything she says has any resonance with anybody.
So it's a fair argument you're making. And I was recently in Iowa, and I followed Governor Palin as she campaigned for a Senate candidate named Joni Ernst. And compared to the 2008 crowds, the 2010 crowds, and even the 2012 crowds, the crowds around Palin this time around are smaller. Her influence, even on the right, is clearly dimming. However, her strain of politics, even if it doesn't really shape the national debate or is really taken seriously by political observers or political leaders, she does represent a certain grassroots fervor, and it's echoed on the blogs, it's echoed at Tea Party rallies, and at these constituency meetings for a lot of congressmen. And so that's why she matters, not as a singular force, but as a representative of a certain type of Republican and conservative who's agitating for more, agitating for a fight against the president.
How do you see her, Jay? And then I do want to move on. Go ahead.
On Sarah Palin?
Yeah.
I guess, you know, I wrote two cover stories on Sarah Palin back in the day, and she is certainly, as Robert said, you know, her star is waning. You know, back in 2010 when I did my last cover story on her, she had enormous impact on the 2010 elections. You know, she really, you could credit her with kind of starting a lot of the primary fights that you see plaguing the Republican Party today, starting with the New York 23rd special election, where, you know, a Tea Party candidate suddenly, you know, rose up and challenged the establishment candidate. It was a complete shocker when it happened that summer. And so these days, yeah, I mean, do people really care if Sarah Palin says, you know, impeach the president? I think there is a small, as Robert said, a small subsect of Republicans who do, who are very passionate, very driven. They're ones who vote in primaries, frankly. So that's how she still has an impact to some degree, in closed primaries at least. But, you know, at the same time, like, you know, obviously I don't think she's the same sort of national star that she was back in the day. I don't know that she could ever run for president again, her voice will linger, and she will always have people interested in what she says, even if it's a small subset of the Republican Party.
Let me shift gears and actually go back to you, Jay. You had an interesting piece about President Obama, the crisis in Ukraine, quoting from some members of Congress, some like Rand Paul, saying the president has been too aggressive, others are saying he's too timid, and the question, and you know, whether he's a tyrant or a weakling, to quote you, how do you see, I guess, some of these foreign policy crises then playing out in the U.S. Congress?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, clearly Congress is, you know, the purview of foreign policy is supposed to be in, you know, very solidly in the executive branch. And so, theoretically, Congress really shouldn't have much of a role. And yet, obviously, throughout history, Congress has had enormous roles in our wars. You know, the War of 1812, they drove us into it. The Mexican-American War, they also drove us into it. You know, they held Franklin Delano Roosevelt back from going into World War II for years and years because Congress didn't want to get involved. They were isolationist.
Not
they
today,
do,
though.
Sorry?
I was going to say not today. I mean, Congress doesn't seem to want to, I mean, have their hands on foreign policy.
Yeah, and so that's sort of the irony, is that they're kind of like backseat drivers at this point. Like, every time something happens, they're very quick to criticize the president, but then when the president actually goes to them for some sort of authorization to do something, they're like, whoa, separation of powers, you know, that's your job. We don't want to do that. You know, like, Syria, for example, I don't think anyone in Congress wanted to vote on whether or not to send, you know, to bomb Syria. Even Libya, you know, the House tried three times to pass a war powers resolution on Libya and failed every time, and then just said, by the end of it, the conflict was already over. They were like, okay, forget it, no big deal, we just won't even worry about it. So it's kind of this very kind of hokey-pokey, you know, one step in, one step out approach to foreign policy, and it just becomes a platform for those running in 2016, I think, to really criticize the president, and plus John McCain, because he just, you know, likes to criticize the president, to really sort of say he's not doing a good enough job, he's not engaging the world, or he's engaging the world too much, and, you know, we need to step back.
How do you see it, Robert? Then we'll get some callers in on the conversation.
What particular part?
Well, just, you know, the fact that you've got a Congress that, and legitimately so, has all sorts of criticisms for the president when it comes to these foreign policy crises, but when asked what to do about it, seem to back away. And perhaps it's just, it doesn't win with the American public. And obviously no easy solutions to anything that we're talking about.
Right. And I think you're bringing up a good point there, Marty, in the sense that Republicans are trying to mount this critique of the president and saying that he has a lack of leadership on foreign policy. A lot of the press releases that flood into my inboxes and probably Jay's every day are really about this leading from behind notion from the right that the president's fundraising while crisis is happening abroad. But when Republicans are asked to articulate and come up with some kind of alternative on foreign policy, it's really not there, and that's because there's a debate right now that's roiling within the Republican ranks about exactly what the party stands for in foreign policy. Sure, John McCain is the hawk, and he's out there, and he's vocal, and he's still a leader on foreign policy, but is he the chief voice? Not so much. Rand Paul, his libertarian brand of foreign policy, it's rising, but has it captured the party? Not yet. And then we have Ted Cruz and others who are trying to navigate this scene. Ted Cruz says he's a Jesse Helms-type person on foreign policy, trying to blend the Paul wing with the McCain wing. It's all kind of a mess over on the Republican side, and so they're really not sure how to move forward, so they just keep making this case against the president. This vague idea of leadership and his ability to come up with some kind of plan.
And that's Robert Costa, national political reporter at the Washington Post. Also with us, Jay Newton Small, the congressional correspondent for Time. And we are talking about national politics, congressional politics, some of the issues that Congress is and isn't grappling with, the president as well. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Interested in you, how you see our political system. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get to Mac from Downingtown to join us. Mac, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I've been very interested in this this conversation. It seems to me that everybody's lost sight of the fact that our federal government is working exactly the way the framers meant it to work. You've got a fractured country. Don't expect your Congress to be not also fractured. The people aren't sure what they want. And the federal Congress was never meant to be able to do a lot of big things easily unless the country really wanted them. You've got the veto, you've got the, both houses have to pass it, a bill, it has to get to the president for signature or veto, and then the override votes, the federal government wasn't meant to be all that efficient.
Well, Mac, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. An interesting perspective. Jay, let me give you a chance to respond to his comment.
Well, certainly let's take the foreign policy front, for example. I absolutely agree. Like, there is not a desire by Americans to do anything on these foreign policy fronts. They are very war weary after more than a decade of war in Afghanistan and Iraq. We've lost a lot of lives, a lot of treasure. And the idea of going into any other country, whether it be Libya or Syria or Ukraine, and sacrificing more American lives and more American treasure is just very unappealing. And poll after poll show Americans really turning more isolationist, not wanting to get involved. And so to the degree that Congress is unwilling to do anything, and it's very unpopular to take votes on going into any of these countries, it's because it's very unpopular with the American people, and they don't want to see Congress doing anything. They don't want to see the president doing anything. On the domestic front, I think that's sort of a harder argument to make because these issues are very pressing. I mean, you can see the VA, for example, that's incredibly unpopular right now. Like, what's going on? There's a huge amount of pressure to fix it. There's a lot of people the polls show huge amounts of support for the VA to get fixed. And so there are, and also with immigration, these young kids coming in, polls also show that there's a desire for Congress to act. The question is, though, Congress is now so broken, will they really be able to? And it's sort of amazing to me about, Robert was talking earlier about how the leadership never talks. And that is, back after the last sort of round of deficit negotiations, you saw Boehner throw up his hands and say, I'm not going to talk to President Obama anymore. I'm going to leave it to the Senate. And now you've got a Senate where, you know, Harry Reid, who's the Democratic leader, and the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, don't talk. Mitch McConnell's in the fight of his life for a re-election campaign back home in Kentucky and has zero incentive to pass any kind of legislation whatsoever that will further imperil his re-election. And so you don't, so it's almost impossible for the Senate to speak to Obama, and it's impossible for the House to speak to Obama. So if nobody's talking to each other, whether you're Senate or House or the White House, it makes it so difficult to get anything done. And you, and the most basic thing is you have to talk to each other, because that's how you come to a compromise. And they're not doing it. And so even on very popular things that where there is momentum, it's having a very, very hard time getting things through.
Well, I'm thinking about gun control when there was support for some more gun control after the massacre in Connecticut, and Congress was not able to pass just a small change to some laws. But Robert Costa, does it then just boil down to relationships, or is it something about rules in Congress? There's just people don't talk to each other, and if you don't talk to each other, you can't get things done.
It's a complicated question, and I think it's a multifaceted answer. One thing I've always noticed, though, is that when you read history and you hear about the 70s and the 80s, when Congress was in a better position for deals, and senators and speakers and presidents were more willing to negotiate and to hash things out, that culture has died. And I think one of the reasons it's faded away is because of this 24/7 media coverage, the constant watchdog atmosphere from these advocacy groups who are taking litmus tests and scorecards on both sides of the aisle, has really made an atmosphere of tension in the Congress. And politicians are not operating out of a total commitment to solving problems and to working together, but often out of fear. And I think that fear is something you always feel is clouding over congressional affairs. And so I think relationships are important, and certainly the Speaker and the President could probably do more to chat with each other and to get things done. But in the partisan, hyper-covered scorecard politics of today, it's difficult for these leaders to get off of their sidelines, to break from their base, because they know they risk every moment of the news cycle from alienating yet another part of their party.
Robert, about a minute. Yeah, no, go ahead, Jay. Go ahead.
Marty, yeah, thanks. If I could just add to that. I mean,
sure.
I agree with Robert completely that there's not a lot of incentive, especially during primary seasons, to be seen to reaching out to the other side. And certainly in the last 12 years since I started covering Congress, things have changed enormously. I mean, it used to be once upon a time that members of Congress stayed in Washington a lot more. They had dinners, their family knew each other. They had social relationships, which they just don't really have right now. But I'm writing a book about the women in Congress, and I think that there are some places where people do still communicate, and certainly the women in Congress have relationships. They were the ones who got together and started talking and stopped the government shutdown and really started the negotiations going to get the government back open again. And so you do see some relationships existing still in Congress that, you know, where people, know each other socially, like each other socially, aren't so hyperpartisan, can actually talk to each other. But even those relationships in this sort of fraught era right now, at least heading into the elections, because the closer we get to an election, the harder it is to do anything, have really kind of not suffered, but it's hard to overcome the huge amount of partisanship that you see. And so on the Senate floor, they had a bunch of test bills where they tried, which were actually sponsored mostly by women, and they tried to overcome the sort of partisanship in the last few months, and they all failed because they just, they're literally, everything is so poisoned right now, and everyone's so worried about their own re-elections, they're not willing to vote on anything.
That's Jay Newton Small. She's the congressional correspondent for Time. Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and continue our conversation with you at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Brick Simple LLC supports WHYY. Serving Fortune 500s to startups, Brick Simple provides technology consulting and app development for the web, iPhone, iPad, Android, and Google Glass. More at BrickSimple.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of how one Polish scientist battled typhus and sabotaged the Nazis. He saved thousands of Jews and intellectuals during the Nazi occupation, some by giving them a typhus vaccine, others by employing them in his lab, where they let body lice suck their blood to produce the vaccine. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
War on two fronts, Ukraine and Gaza.
The burden now is on Russia to insist that the separatists stop tampering with the evidence. We have serious concerns about the rising number of Palestinian civilian deaths and the loss of Israeli lives.
Two-pronged turmoil for the Obama administration. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
PNC Arts Alive and Koresh Dance Company support WHYY and present the second annual Come Together Dance Festival, showcasing the creativity and diversity of Philadelphia's dance community, July 23rd through the 27th. For tickets, koreshdance.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Robert Costa and Jay Newton-Small. And we are talking about the state of our political system, some of the issues that have been on the table, why it's so hard to get legislation passed in Congress. And we do want to talk a bit about some of the upcoming races and the fact that people like Elizabeth Warren are getting a lot of support when she's out there talking to people, for instance, at the Netroots Conference. So give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We have a message from Kate from Morristown. She says, I think that Congress is a big joke and that we look like morons to the rest of the world. And Robert, I think what's worrisome is that either people will get turned off to politics, they won't vote because they don't think it makes a difference, and perhaps we do look like morons or half morons to the rest of the world.
I think sometimes, of course, it's easy to say that we do look like we're a confused political. We have a confused politics right now in the United States. But I think the first caller had another point, is that maybe this is part of the intent of the founders, just to always have some kind of back and forth between the sides. But I think the level of partisanship, the continued gridlock, it does send a certain signal abroad, and it sends a certain signal to not only abroad but to the markets here in the U.S., to business leaders, to people who are in small communities. They wonder why can't Washington work? And I think on foreign policy, sometimes it is difficult when you have a president who's not able to get along with congressional leaders, and when it comes to immigration aid or when it comes to coming up with a solution for Ukraine and dealing with Putin, there's really not much consensus. But this has always been the story of America. There's always been bitter battles. Just because it's not perfect kumbaya doesn't mean the country's falling apart.
Jay, let me ask you something else, and this has to do with the transportation bill. Where does that stand, and do you think it'll pass and have an impact?
Well, we're talking about this fix, right? This
yes.
is a short-term patch where the Transportation Trust Fund, which is a fund that's funded between the federal government and the states to build massive, highway projects, bridges, things like that, has fallen short. So the gas tax that funds it, it no longer meets the demands that, of the projects that the states have started. And as of the beginning of August, they're going to be $12 billion in the hole for this fiscal year. Work on projects will literally start ceasing unless they fill this hole. And so they kind of have to. I mean, there really isn't a choice. They really have to find this fix, and they will. I feel like there's already a deal on the table, to sort of, a lot of people say it's kind of a fuzzy math fix, but at this point, in the Congress, you don't really have a lot of choice in how you do things so close to an election. They're going to do something called pension smoothing, which will allow companies to sort of give less to pensions. It's sort of this kind of, it's hard to explain.
I hear you.
Essentially, they will give them the money that they need. It's a bipartisan deal. It looks like it's likely to go through to some degree through both chambers. And so I think there will be a fix. But again, nothing's sure until it's sure, until it's actually passed the chambers.
Robert, let me go back to you. You had a piece recently about Elizabeth Warren. You describe her as the liberal superstar. Now, it's not clear at all, and she says she is not running for president. Nonetheless, she gets a lot of enthusiastic support, it seems, when she goes to these events. What is her appeal, do you think, to Democrats?
Very broad, very deep appeal to Democrats. Jay and I were both in West Virginia on last Monday, and we saw Elizabeth Warren wow a crowd in a red state, fighting for Natalie Tennant, stumping for Natalie Tennant, the Democratic candidate there for Senate. This is someone in Warren who speaks as a true and natural populist. This is not a political shtick. This is not an effect. Elizabeth Warren, because of her ability to go after the banks and to lay out a vision for building more infrastructure in the country, for fixing student loans, for changing the tax code, she is resonating not just with liberals in the blue cities of America, but across the country in some of these red states. And that's a powerful force. And she may not be planning for a presidential run in 2016, but if you're going to West Virginia and you're going to Minnesota and you're going to Michigan, like Elizabeth Warren, she's gone a lot of other places too, she's certainly building national profile, and she's going to shape that 2016 primary, whether she runs or not, forcing Hillary Clinton to more closely grapple with the issues that are on the minds of progressives.
Well, let me pick up on that, and Jay, I'd just be curious, as we know Hillary Clinton finishing up her book tour, seems like sales fell off pretty immediately. Is there a message to Hillary Clinton coming from people like Elizabeth Warren?
I think absolutely you already see the Warren effect on Clinton. You know, she was asked by Charlie Rose earlier this week, what's the number one problem affecting America? What should be the first priority of the next president of the United States? And she said income inequality, which to me was like, that is absolutely an Elizabeth Warren influence, because, you know, she sees her, the left just hungering for somebody to challenge her, which was sort of what happened in 2007, right? The left was hungered for a challenger and they got Barack Obama, and that's how Hillary Clinton lost it. And so I think she's being very careful to tend to the left, to trek to the left in her rhetoric, and I think you'll see that more and more as she hits the campaign trail herself this fall, because she's very aware of what Elizabeth Warren is saying, and to some degree that's very smart of Elizabeth Warren, because she keeps, even though she denies that she's ever going to run for president in 2016, she makes herself very relevant by forcing Hillary to look over her shoulder all the time at what Warren is saying and what the Democratic Party is responding to.
Jay, you had a piece about Bernie Sanders. He says, I'm better than Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yeah. Well, Bernie is wants to run for president, and certainly he is looking to fill that sort of Democratic hungering. Bernie, first of all, has to switch parties before he decides
to run.
Right,
he's an independent,
He's an independent from Vermont. He's actually the only self-declared socialist in Congress. But Bernie's, as much as, he is very popular with the left, I don't know that he is viable with, for a general election, that he could actually trek to the center and win it. So he certainly will raise his profile. He will get a lot of attention for running against Hillary, and will, to some degree, force her to the left in debates and in other areas. But he doesn't have the mass-wide appeal that somebody like Elizabeth Warren has, really, in states like Kentucky, where she campaigned a couple of weeks ago, where she was treated, I was told by somebody in Kentucky, that no Democrat except for Bill Clinton has been treated like such a rock star coming into Kentucky in the last decade. And that's just striking, because her anti-Wall Street message is just so popular both on the left and on the right.
And Hillary Clinton giving very expensive speeches to some of these Wall Street firms. Let me go back to you, Robert Costa, and even look at some of the Democrats. I talked to a journalist recently from Texas. He says Rick Perry is absolutely running for president. Chris Christie making noises. He was in Iowa recently. Ted Cruz. What do you see on that side of the political aisle?
It's going to be a wild Republican primary.
Kind of like the last wild political primary for the Republicans.
Right. And I think it's indicative of 2012. When you have candidates like Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain last time get such coverage and really increase their national profile, perhaps their speaking fees after the presidential run last time, there's really no reason for a lot of people not to consider it. And then you already see people like former UN Ambassador John Bolton. He's making moves around the country. Ben Carson, the former director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins, who's a favorite of the right, an African-American. He's making speeches and traveling around. He'll be in Iowa very soon. So you have some of these minor names that are never really even mentioned about in a lot of national news coverage, but they're bubbling up. They're getting some play. But then the bigger names that we really got to watch, Jeb Bush, does he get in or not? Chris Christie, can he recover? Mike Huckabee, does he wade back in? Does he think he can be an evangelical candidate? Ted Cruz of Texas, does he become the force on the right, the new Santorum this time around? Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, he's trying to become more of the wonk of the race, especially if Paul Ryan doesn't run from Wisconsin. Perry's trying to have his rehab. Mike Pence of Indiana, he's been meeting with donors. Rand Paul, of course, a major player on this scene. And then Marco Rubio, he's trying to come back in his own way, not as bad as Chris Christie, his stumble on immigration, but he's certainly trying to be a force again. So it's a wide open field, a lot of names, a lot of players, and pretty colorful.
We have a tweet from Rusty. How can the electorate help influence and move government toward a more consensus-driven, pragmatic style of leadership? Jay, do you have any ideas for Rusty?
Well, I think you saw Chuck Schumer today in the New York Times had a op-ed, which I thought was really interesting, and I've actually really thought this for a long time since California opened up its primaries 4 years ago, that, part of the problem is our primary system, and, having closed primaries where you have really only the devoted base vote and the silent majority of independents have no say whatsoever in who the primary candidates are, and also the gerrymandered districts, these districts that are just completely rigged to be, hyper-Republican or hyper-Democrat, and so those two combined create this hyper-partisan house that makes it very hard for incumbents they're much more afraid of getting primaried than they are of actually losing the general election, and so therefore there's no incentive for them to compromise. So California 4 years ago opened up their primary system, said, look, we're going to have it, the districts will be drawn by a nonpartisan committee, and the top two vote-getters are going to go ahead and have a runoff. Anyone can vote in the primaries, and Republican or Democrat, anyone can vote in the general election. And it's created the first moderates in Congress in years, frankly, and the only ones that have safe seats. And so I think that, Chuck Schumer called on all states to have these open primary systems, and a lot of states are considering it. I think that would be a huge step into reintroducing pragmatism and compromise, frankly, which has become a dirty word, back into politics.
Robert, we have a comment from John from Reading. Could they comment on congressional term limits? Should they be changed? This is an idea that seems to come and go. Does it have any legs, do you think?
No, and I sometimes you hear lawmakers occasionally bring up term limits as something they'd like to see happen. But as you said, Marty, I mean, this has been going on for two-plus decades. It's an active debate. And the greatest ability to have term limits is to have voters vote people out. And we do see some cleansing going on. I mean, really, if we reflect on this year, the most significant event to me when you look at Congress is Eric Cantor's defeat. And not only in telling us how politicians, of course, need to pay attention to their home districts, but broadly, politically, nationally, this is someone who has been taken out by his primary opponent. And this is it's indicative of the fear I was talking about, that many of these members feel, that there's always a David Brat around the corner. And if that's the way you operate, and that's what you think is on the horizon, that's really going to cripple any kind of effort to get something done with a partner on the other side of the aisle. And that's where we stand, I think, in a lot of ways on Capitol Hill.
Would you also add to that in Mississippi the near defeat of Thad Cochran?
I think so, too. Thad Cochran, if it wasn't open registration in Mississippi, which enables independents and Democrats, so those who lean that way, they don't register by party affiliation. If it wasn't like that in Mississippi, I think Thad Cochran would have lost. Mm-hmm. I spent 2 weeks in Mississippi following Senator Cochran around, meeting with Chris McDaniel and covering his campaign. And that was very much a David Brat-style fervor on the right. And Cochran was savvy. He was smart. He reached out to Democrats, and he got a lot of them to vote for him, more liberals side of things. But if this was a closed primary, it would have been, I think, a repeat of Eric Cantor.
Interesting. Jay, you had a fascinating piece in Time that senators in Congress can write their own family leave policy, something I had no idea they could do. Help us understand how they do it and the fact that the policies really cover a bit of the gamut.
So Congress, this is something that a lot of people don't realize, is that Congress is not subject to the laws it passes. And so all of this sort of OSHA and, you know, equal treatment of, you know, I guess you could say races or sexes or anything else like that, Congress is totally exempt from it. So each senator and, frankly, each House member has the ability to make their own, maternity and paternity leaves. They're not subject to the federal sort of standards that are out there. And to be fair, most of them go beyond. I mean, right now there is no mandated paid maternity leave in the United States. It's just mandated that, you know, women can take a break of up to 3 months unpaid leave without any kind of punitive repercussions, but most of them do offer paid leave of some form, whether it's 2 weeks, 2 months, 3 months. But it's interesting because Democrats have been pushing really hard in this midterm elections to expand maternity leave, paid maternity leave, across the country, pass it into law. There's all these bills that they have before Congress. Republicans say it's too expensive, that they wouldn't support such an idea unless it was offset and paid for it with cuts, which Democrats won't do. So you have this issue that is out there as they try to appeal to female voters in November, and in their own sort of office. Democrats are actually not necessarily the leaders on maternity leave. It's actually split by generation. And so you see the younger members, younger senators, having the best maternity leave policies, and the older senators still having sort of antiquated policies. So those like Dianne Feinstein, Carl Levin, those who are in their 80s, Patrick Leahy, they have sort of less generous policies. And folks like Kirsten Gillibrand, David Vitter, the younger generation having much more generous policies because they're used to a much more modern workforce.
And we're almost out of time here, Robert. So the clock is ticking. When does Congress leave? And do you two then get a little break yourself?
It leaves in a few days. It always breaks in early August. And knowing Jay and I, we'll probably not get too much of a break. We'll head out to the campaign trails, cover some of these tight Senate races and maybe even that Pennsylvania gubernatorial race. See if
yes.
Tom Corbett can catch up.
The Perpetual Campaign. Well, my thanks to both of you, Robert Costa, Jay Newton Small. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Jay Newton Small, the congressional correspondent for Time. Robert Costa is national political reporter at the Washington Post. Grew up here in the Philadelphia area. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including the newsletter and how to find us on Facebook and how to find us on Twitter as well. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.